Good evening and welcome to Dialect for Sunday the 25th of April. This week we have the Labour Party's in and we'll be asking them how they plan to get Britain back on its economic feet again. For those disillusioned with the lack of difference between the three main parties, which they always deny, of course, we talk to David Phipps. He's a member of a new initiative called the Albion Alliance, who put forward a different political vision for the future. Sex trafficking of girls as young as 9 years old. We have the second part of Anthea Page's extraordinary interview with a young Israeli activist. Plus, good old Eddie Shoestring. For those of you with long memories, he was a fictional Radio West private investigator, dramatised by BBC Bristol in 1979 and 1980, and provides our Dialect theme tune every week. But why have the BBC not released this gripping drama filmed in and around Bristol? And how can you get hold of a copy of the two series on DVD? Well, it's a pleasure to start this week with formerly technically sitting MP Kerry McCarthy and now parliamentary candidate for Bristol East and Twitter czar, Kerry McCarthy.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
So I understand technically you are no longer a member of Parliament as such.
No, I stopped being a member of Parliament last Monday, 5 o'clock, the moment Parliament was dissolved. We're not allowed to call ourselves MPs anymore.
Right, okay. So give us a little insight into, you know, what can you continue to do as an MP at all if you no longer an MP?
Basically, you can still carry on with casework. I mean, I deal with absolutely hundreds of cases on behalf of constituents, although they're now just residents and not constituents. Yeah. So if I've already been taking up an issue on their behalf, I can carry on doing that. It's made a lot more difficult, though, because we have things like on immigration cases, you have an MP's hotline.
Yeah.
And the same with the DWP and Job Centre, and we're not allowed to use them anymore.
Oh, so it's almost
like an ordinary member of the public taking up a case on behalf of somebody and having to go through all the hurdles that they have to.
Okay, so you're sort of awkwardly half suspended.
Yes, yeah. And it does make life a little bit difficult. And it's in Bristol East, it's not helped by the fact there's boundary changes. So there's quite a few people that I'm helping at the moment that will go into the new constituency at the election. So that's all quite tricky as well.
Okay, well, the hot news this week has certainly been that Nick Clegg is now sort of the great new hope now that the Liberals have done so well on television. And some polls, particularly in sort of Daily Mail and articles and such like, show Labour third behind the Liberals. And this is quite a strong Liberal city. So how do you think you're going to do? How do you think Labour are going to be represented after the election?
I mean, I think it's a bit too soon to judge whether the Clegg bounce, if you like to call it that, you know, the aftermath of the Leasers debate is actually long lasting, and there's two more debates to come, and I think particularly the one on the economy will show Gordon at his strongest and probably Nick Clegg at his weakest. There's no doubt that it has had a little bit of an impact. I go out canvassing, I've just come from sort of out talking to voters,
yeah.
And I think honestly before the Leaders debate nobody ever mentioned Nick Clegg. It was as if they didn't know who he was. And, you know, it's starting to crop up a bit more. But I think it'll probably be, you know, it'll be of most interest in the Bristol West seat, where it's a Liberal Democrat MP at the moment, and boundary changes that don't particularly help him. So, you know, he might find that it helps in his favour.
Doesn't Gordon Brown might possibly be regressing his appearance on TV?
No, because I think Gordon did pretty well. You know, he was... Yeah, I'm obviously biased anyway, but although I think Nick Clegg came across as like confident and self-assured, but in terms of substance and who came across the most prime ministerial, I would say that Gordon did. And the main thing about doing the debate was that David Cameron was the one challenging him to do it. And if there was a loser from the debates, it certainly wasn't Gordon Brown, it was David Cameron. And I think he has been shown up as completely lacking in any substance. And, you know, he just seemed completely rattled by the experience. And if you actually look at the polls now, the big story of it is, yeah, you know, all the three parties are pretty close together now. And the Lib Dems have gained slightly at Labour's expense, but it's the Tories that have really dropped. They were nearly at the 40% mark. They're now down towards the 30% mark, and they can't win the election on that.
OK, do you think there's a chance of a Labour-Liberal coalition, possibly? I mean, that would...
Obviously, if there's a hung parliament and there's no one party has the majority, you would think that common sense would dictate that we have more in common with the Liberal Democrats than... I can never imagine a Labour-Conservative coalition. I just couldn't see that happening because there's no identity of interest. But the thing is with the Liberal Democrats is that it's very difficult to pin down actually where they are on the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And a month or so ago, we did have sort of noises coming from the Lib Dem camp that they would actually favour a coalition with the Conservatives. And I think that's because a lot of their seats are Lib Dem Conservative marginals. Yeah. So they're trying to win over those Tory voters. And you had Nick Clegg in The Spectator describing himself as the heir to Thatcher and things, and talking about savage cuts at the speech he made. So, you know, would we want to get into bed with a party that described themselves as the heir to Thatcher? No. But actually, if you did go through it policy by policy, I think you would find that the Lib Dems have got more in common with us than with the Conservatives.
I mean, the state of the economy is the really big issue at the moment. We've got about 45 business leaders all backing the Conservatives at the moment, and the Business First lobby group have sort of been paying a lot of attention to Tory tax policy. So, I mean, how...
They would, wouldn't they? I mean, if you look at when we introduced the minimum wage, you had all the business leaders then saying that it was going to cost jobs, it was going to be a drain on the economy and all that. And it wasn't, you know, and actually, you know, the minimum wage worked incredibly well and we've managed to put it up year after year. And the same with the, you know, the national insurance increase, if you actually, which is what they're talking about in terms of, you know, being a tax on jobs. If you look at the actual amount it would cost a business, I think it's something like about £15 a month or something.
There have been some savage criticisms of the fact that Gordon Brown's continued to spend far too much money for far too long.
Well, it's a difference of opinion. I mean, if you, I think it was still in the last week, you had about 70 economists writing a letter to the papers, you know, to sort of counter the letter from business people saying that we'd done entirely the right thing, because if you cut spending when you're in the middle of a recession, you actually, you know, you're pulling the plug on absolutely everything. I mean, if we hadn't bailed out the banks, if we hadn't sort of carried on spending to, you know, keep people in work, I've been visiting things like housing schemes in Bristol where the private sector developers couldn't get the funding to continue it. The government put some money in under its Kickstart programme, got housing associations in, so you've kept the builders in work, you've kept the housing, yeah, you've provided affordable housing. Yeah. And if we'd just done nothing, which is what the Conservatives wanted us to do, we really would have been in difficulties.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about Afghanistan, because that's been left off the radar pretty much entirely of late because of the economy. I mean, we're supposed to be there preventing terrorism. Some would say that we're actually encouraging it, and we've now been there for longer than the Second World War. I mean, what are your views on our presence in Afghanistan? Are voters asking you much about it?
No, it's not an issue in my neck of the woods. It's not come up on the doorstep at all. I mean, the leaders' debate that is going out this Thursday, which is being filmed in Bristol, is focusing on foreign affairs, and I'm sure that will come up. I mean, I think one of the issues that has sort of been touched on in a sort of peripheral way has been the question about whether the troops are getting enough support and whether the equipment's there and so on. But I've not really had people questioning our motives for being there. And I think that's probably the nature of my constituency, whereas I'm sure if you get into Bristol West, which is a very different sort of constituency, you would get more people
there
to talk in that. You know, I think, you know, I mean, I didn't support the Iraq war. I didn't support the decision to go in there. I think with Afghanistan, you know, there is a real need to sort of support the Afghan government is not ideal by any means. You know, there are real question marks about the way elections and things are being conducted.
Yeah.
But I think there is a need to support them to try and get stability in the country. And there's also a need to work with the Pakistan government for that reason as well. But, you know, and there is a lot of good work being done in Afghanistan. My recent parliamentary role was as aide to the Secretary of State for International Development. And when you actually see some of the work that's been done, say, in getting young girls into school and trying to sort of stop the poppy harvest and give them other... You know, all the focus is on the military side of Afghanistan, but actually there's a lot of good work that's going on there to try and rebuild the country. And that's being facilitated by the fact that we've got the troops there to make, you know, bring in... a sort of semblance of security on the ground.
I understand that you were a whip in your time as a member of parliament. I mean, tell me a little bit, how do you get MPs to toe the line? What does that entail? What do you do?
It's really not about that. I mean, people always have this idea that whips are all about twisting people's arm and getting them to vote a certain way. A lot of it is just about, a lot of it is just about making sure that people are around. So it's a bit difficult to explain succinctly, but basically, as a whip, I'm responsible, because I'm from the southwest, for the southwest backbenchers.
Mm-hmm.
So people like Roger Berry and Doug Naismith and David Drew or whatever. And if you know those characters, you know they're pretty strong-willed, and they're not the sort that I could actually sort of twist the arm or put the cushion on, whatever, to get them to do. But I would have conversations with them about how they were feeling about things.
Yep.
So, for example, if Roger thought that the government was going really down the wrong path on something, I would talk to him and feed that back into ministers. So it's almost, you know, it's
that intermediary. Relationship.
It's a two-way thing because it's... When ministers are in government, you can, you know, you're relying on the advice of civil servants, and you can, to an extent, get slightly out of touch with how MPs are feeling.
There is bound to be a dilemma in that if there is constituency pressure to vote one way, you might be telling them that the party line really is another.
Yeah, well, the thing, I mean, we're all Labour MPs that were elected on a Labour manifesto to, you know, to basically... I think it's slightly egotistical to assume that you were elected just because of how wonderful you are as an individual. You were elected because people wanted a Labour government and a Labour MP. So that's the sort of starting point, is that, you know, by and large, I don't have a problem with supporting most of what the Labour government's doing because, you know, you would expect me to agree with the Labour government on most of those issues.
But what if most of your constituents are saying, well, we want you to represent us in this way, and you're being asked to represent them in another?
Yeah, I mean, and I think you saw that, particularly with Iraq, where I wasn't in Parliament with the Iraq vote, but a lot of MPs, you know, were very aware of very strong feelings amongst their constituents on things. Since, I mean, I've only been a whip for less than a year, and we've not really had issues that have come up to that extent. We haven't had the sort of big controversial votes. And I think the one thing you've got to be really careful about is making sure that you genuinely know what your constituents feel, because sometimes there can be a very vocal minority that will be the ones that contact you about things. So just because you could maybe receive like 50 emails on something. But if you actually went out and polled everyone in your area,
you might find it different.
Like, for example, you know, say something like the fox hunting ban. It might be people who actually think that the ban is totally, you know, a breach of infringement of their civil liberties and that are all up in arms. You know, the Countryside Alliance march. Would you listen to them, or would you actually realise, because you know your constituency, that those people aren't representative? I got lobbied like mad, and my blog got hijacked by people who opposed the smoking ban.
Right, okay.
And yet, it's actually quite popular. So you've got to be a bit careful about how you judge how people feel.
Well, I'll stop you there and stow you while, because I'm going to introduce David Phipps of the Albion Alliance for a chat. Hello.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for having me.
So how old is the Albion Alliance as an organisation?
We started it... the idea first came to fruition at the end of October last year.
Okay, and what is the... Are you a political party? Is that what you...
No, we are a non-party political campaign. We are primarily set up for two reasons. The main one is to get all candidates standing at the general election to pledge that they will either initiate and or support...
Yep.
Within the first year of Parliament, a referendum on the country's membership of the European Union.
Okay.
And the second is that they will put country before party. Now, a lot of MPs were elected on a manifesto. Labour MPs were elected on a manifesto to grant a referendum.
Indeed.
And they reneged on it.
Okay, yeah.
And that is an instance of the party putting party before country.
Okay, I'll just switch back to Kerry McCarthy briefly. I mean, do you support the idea of a referendum?
I mean, are you talking about a referendum on the EU constitution or on
membership of the European Union?
I don't. I mean, to sort of give you a very brief answer, I mean, we had a referendum on our membership of the European Union back in the 70s, and I don't sense any great appetite amongst the public. You've got a party standing for election, UKIP, that is committed to withdrawal from the UK. The withdrawal of the UK from the EU, and they only get a handful of votes across the country. And I think that's representative of the way that people feel. It's not a burning issue. I don't get very many people contacting me about it.
So, to interrupt, that's why you got hammered in the last elections that were held in this country in June last year.
Well, UKIP didn't exactly top the polls, did they?
No, but we came second and we beat the Lib Dems and we
David,
beat you.
In the South West.
Tell me a little bit about the political standing of the Albion Alliance. I mean, a lot of people maybe put off UKIP, for example, because they see them as sort of closet Tories or a right-wing conservative movement. I mean, is that sort of where the Albion Alliance come from?
No, the Albion Alliance, there's four people that run the Albion Alliance. Mm-hmm. One is a Tory, one is UKIP, one is a Libertarian, and the fourth one is a Libertarian Light.
Right, there's not exactly a lot of left-wing view represented there, really, is there?
Whether it's represented or not is neither here nor there, with respect. All the actual outcome of a referendum, mm-hmm. whether it went yes or no, we're not interested in. What we are interested in is that which was promised to the electorate of this country actually happens.
Okay. I mean, if the UKIP or if the United Kingdom Independence Party are saying exactly the same thing as Trevor Colman told us they were last week, I mean, why form the Albion Alliance as a sort of cross-party thing? Why not just support
because
the UKIP?
Because we are trying to get Labour, Liberal, Democrats and Conservatives mm-hmm. to sign up to this idea.
Okay, are you succeeding?
We've had two Liberal Democrats, three Conservatives. The rest of the signatories have all been from the what Labour and the others like to call the minor parties.
Okay. I mean, are you just sort of generally quite obsessed with the European Union? I mean, why is the EU so important rather than, you know, just sort of concentrating on British politics?
It's not just the European Union, because ultimately we think there is a big democratic deficit in this country. The MPs do not listen to their constituents. Local government as such is a sham mm-hmm. because you have got, to take West Oxfordshire where I live, 49 councillors, 7 are in the cabinet, and all they are doing is implementing central government diktats, and the other 42 are in effect disenfranchised.
Okay, and do you believe a similar thing could be here in Bristol? Do you know, what is your knowledge of Bristol?
I think, I must be honest, I don't know Bristol's makeup. But I think it is endemic right across the country.
Okay, I mean, what do you think about the Treaty of Lisbon and sort of things like the Pachereau Clause and stuff like that? I mean, do you think that, what is the difference between sovereignty and power, I guess is what I'm saying, is we've had some of our sovereignty taken away. Do you feel that the British government has lost power to actually govern over the country as a result? Is that what concerns?
Well, it has, because there's various figures bandied about. Dennis McShane, Labour MP for Rotherham, reckons it's only 9%. Other people say it's 70, between 70 and 80% of laws that govern this country originate in Brussels.
I mean, you're a sceptical only sort of alliance then. I mean, it seems that you're very sort of Eurosceptic, even though you say that you're not worried about what the result would be of a referendum.
No, not the actual referendum. We are campaigning to get the referendum. Mm-hmm. The political implications of yes or no to that referendum is not our concern.
Okay, so once if people say, well, yes, we are actually quite supportive, the Albion Alliance, you know, having been a referendum, you will just pack up shop and that's the end of it?
Yes.
Okay. So, Kerry, we've heard from David Phipps there. I mean, we've had quite a few people in from UKIP, and we've spoken to the Albion Alliance, and the UKIP are getting quite a lot of support, and the fact that they're a party in the first place. There would appear to be a lot of opinion and discourse on the subject of the EU. Surely we need a referendum. Surely opinions have changed since the early 70s, was nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, but, there's always an issue as to how many topics that you have referendums on. And certainly, I mean, I was out in America for Obama's election, and there I was in Miami, and they were voting on about, you know, 20 or 30 different things, because that's the way. Yeah, but I mean, you could say we're going into this election with a manifesto to, pledge to hold a referendum on changing the voting system to alternative vote. Mm. We're going into the election with a manifesto commitment to hold a referendum on getting rid of the House of Lords and having an elected House of Lords. And I think actually they're more fundamental. You know, you couldn't get a more fundamental impact on our democracy than changing the voting system.
We've lost an element of sovereignty. Is that not of equal importance, really?
Well, it's something. I mean, you know, Parliament has to ratify these treaties, and I would sort of say, you know, there was something that at one stage was described as the EU constitution. The Lisbon Treaty is not the same as the EU constitution, which is why there wasn't a referendum.
Yes, it is, Kerry. But the only thing, Scott, forgive me interrupting, the only thing that was dropped was the flag and the anthem. And it has been admitted by God. How many knows European leaders? It's the same thing.
Well, I would dispute that. And we actually spent a whole month in Parliament debating the Lisbon Treaty. So there are people who are elected to go to Parliament and debate such things. They're democratically elected. So there was democratic input in terms of...
You say we have to ratify what comes from Brussels. But, I mean, if Britain's lost its veto... what power do we really have to sort of say, well, we're not going to put through these laws without basically sort of dissolving our membership of the EU, effectively?
Well, the thing is, we are represented during all the negotiations anyway, you know, through the Council of Ministers and obviously in the EU Parliament and sessions. So yeah, there's democracy at various stages of it in that we are having a say. But the EU is fundamentally about finding a compromise. And if you had each member state, you know, particularly now that we've got the enlarged EU, you know, if one of those parties was able to veto and, you know, and exercise the veto sort of willy-nilly, you'd find that you'd never ever actually get consensus on anything across the EU. You would actually never make progress on things. Right. So, you know, it's, we have to accept that, you know, being part of the EU does involve, to an extent, making compromises, but I think the benefits outweigh the disadvantages.
Okay, well, there we go, David. So there are benefits that outweigh the disadvantages, and we have to learn to compromise.
No, I'm sorry. We live in a democracy. I think Kerry would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the basic tenets of a democracy is the ability to elect and unelect those that represent you. And right, we can't do any of that with any of the EU. So how you can say it's a democratic organisation, I just cannot understand your line of thought.
I mean, the Council of Ministers are our representatives. You know, we have everybody from Gordon Brown downwards. Will at some point take, you know, if it's a transport issue, it will be our transport ministers that go. They are elected members of the UK Parliament that you're quite happy to have represent you when they're making laws that are just UK laws. So I don't see what the issue is with sending them over to Europe to negotiate on our behalf. And obviously we've also got the European Parliament to scrutinise decisions.
So we're running out of time there, but tell us a little bit more about how people can find out about the Albion Alliance if people are interested in getting involved.
The web address is www.albionalliance.org, and on there they will find a database of every declared candidate that is standing in every constituency, together with, where known, email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers, and copies of any correspondence that we have had with the candidates.
Okay. And just Kerry McCarthy, lastly, I mean, will you be continuing to be the Twitter czar for Labour if you should come back in?
Oh, dear. I wish that nobody had ever coined that phrase. I'm, to be honest, I'm, like, totally sick of being called it. But, you know, I will continue to use Twitter because I think it's fun and it is really a good way of communicating with people. And I think the more accessible you can make yourself to constituents across the board. But if I can possibly get rid of having that tag attached to me, I would love it.
Very briefly, to members of, you know, to residents of Bristol East, what is it about you as opposed to Labour and Conservatives what is the reason they should vote for you and how you're going to represent them?
Well, I think, I mean, you just have to look at the last 5 years when I think most people would say that I've worked really hard. And that thing about making yourself accessible and actually being there, a lot of MPs, you know, particularly when they're sitting on a reasonable sized majority, just sort of... you know, coast along. And, you know, I've been out all day from 9 o'clock this morning actually meeting constituents, and I do that on a sort of very regular basis. I've got an office full of thank you cards for all the casework that I've dealt with. Brilliant. And I like to think I've done a good job.
All right, well, the people will speak. Exactly. Thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time now, slightly incongruously, for a track from Now 96. This is Duty Free and their track Bus to Waco. And we broadcast this as a sort of homage to the American way, and in particular our habit of replicating their televised presidential debates that we've just done recently. ¶¶
Ronald McDonald and country music too. Thanks for killing Indians and animals in zoos.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, and chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your decent brown butter wacko.
Cheers for all the sitcoms and the Ku Klux Klan. Thanks for joining in the war and bombing up Japan.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your decent brown butter wacko.
Thanks for making crack cocaine and calling women hoes. Thanks for Jerry Springer and all those other shows.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your knees and brown buster wacko.
Thanks again for Disney and the values it betrays. Thanks for showing all of us your Yankee fascist ways.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your knees and brown buster wacko.
Thanks for turning Santa red just for Coca-Cola. Thanks for knowing what was best for people in Angola.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your knees to the grand buster wacko.
Thanks for Pizza Hut and not forgetting Ben and Jerry. Thanks for all the oil wars we're seeing on the telly.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your knees to the grand buster wacko.
Thanks for Mickey Mouse and petrol-thirsty cars. Thanks for colouring the world in pretty stripes and stars.
Cowboy hats, leather chaps, chewing on tobacco. Rest in peace and take your knees and a grand buster wacko.
That was Buster Waco by Duty Free from Now 96, in all shops now, or not. Last week, we broadcast Anthony Page's extraordinary interview with a young Israeli activist called David, and he discussed Gaza in Palestine. Anthony continues to interview him this week, and it's a different topic. It's sex trafficking of girls as young as 9 years old, and his knowledge of the exploitation of the world's poor, and specifically sex trafficking between Nepal and India.
I tell you what, from my experience with working with homeless people, it's amazing that every time that you speak about this subject and every time that you want to help, you have to remember that if you help a person in a low point, like being a homeless people in a big city, if you help him, you encourage other people from the suburbs, from the villages to come to the city and to be supported. And so every time you want to help, but at the same time you help, you also maintain the situation. You don't want to maintain. And this is the problem that I personally faced in India and Nepal. Because if you bring 10 rupees for a kid, or you bring him food in the street, then tomorrow another kid from the village will come to the city, because in the village he's only dreaming about the 10 rupees you will give him in the street. And I don't want to do it.
What about trafficking?
Trafficking is horrible. It's again emphasizing the cruel mechanism. The person comes. Sometimes in Nepal, it can be an uncle of the girl. And he will come to the parents and convince them to give him the girl, and he will get her to Kathmandu to get education. And it's well known for these people that the Nepalese women are much more beautiful than Indian women. And so they take advantage of it, because once you get her out of the border, into the Indian border, that's it, you can do whatever you want, you can sell her. And this guy, a member of the family that they trust, and he will sell her. It's nothing, it's a little bit money in the pocket. And he doesn't give a damn about her and the horrors she will have to face, getting pregnant while she's 9 years old. And go through another abortion and another abortion and another, until she doesn't have anything in her body that can support. She's not a woman anymore.
How do they get them through the border then?
By walking. The border is open. They can walk across the mountains. They can walk across the cities in the border. They can hitchhike over the border. One guy can take a van with 30 women and go across the border. And okay, if there is an organization that take care of something, you will question him. But if the organization is not there, the government doesn't care.
How do you know all this?
Because I volunteer there, and I spend there a very strong and intense 4 months. I really took the time to understand it and to study the language and to study the things are the way things are going there.
Did you see girls being trafficked?
Yes. I was at one point in the border when we stopped a person. And this is, again, to emphasize the complexity of the situation. A 19-year-old guy come with 18-year-old girl. And now you need to stop him. Because you don't know if it's his girlfriend, his wife. He told her some story about how they're going to spend their honeymoon in India, and he's actually someone is waiting over the border, and he's going to get some money and to sell her. And you don't know, and we arrested this guy. We put the girl in one room with the girls of the organization, and they questioned her, and we took this guy, and the guys questioned him, and eventually we got her parents to take her from the border because we didn't know. Because she's saying she lives in a village, her father is an alcoholic, he beat her.
Did you see any younger girls trafficked, you know, like 9, 10?
A man arrives with 3 little girls. Some things that you simply don't know. And the people in the border, they do good work.
Did they get bribed, the border people?
Oh, well, not the organization people. The people in the organization are usually very motivated to stop the phenomenon. If you go to Kathmandu, you have 25,000 organizations working in Kathmandu, and this is exactly a part of the corruption.
What sort of...
What sort of organization? You go to another niche now, because... A guy can say, okay, I'm a volunteer, I'm non-profit organization, and I want to open an orphanage in Kathmandu. And he will register, and he will get some money from the government to run this orphanage. Eventually, what's going on? He brings 13, 20 kids to a house, to an abandoned house, doesn't give them food, doesn't give them education, doesn't give them any kind of support. These kids will eventually go to the street, sniff glue, not eat anything, and be supported by stupid tourists. They don't understand the situation and they give them money. And you go to Kathmandu, you have 25,000 organizations. How can you distinguish one from each other, which is right, which is not right? I faced a lot of big questions. For example, if I want to teach somebody English or not, because once a person in Nepal know English, it means that he is able to communicate with tourists, and means that he's obviously going to be a part of the system. It's just too much. Poor people, of course they're being exploited. It's the easiest thing to move them from here to there, from here to there. Look at the world. Look at the situation in the world. British people, they want to eat cashew nuts. And so they went to India and they told Indian people, okay, destroyed 40 acres of this natural forest and plant here cashew nuts trees. Okay? Because we want to eat it. And you get some money for it. Now you don't get any money for the forest. And what happened? Maybe 0.01% of the natural forest of South India remained. And it's nothing. And those people used to live from these woods, cotton, fruits, firewood, building wood, vegetables, everything. And now they don't have anything. It builds dependence. Of who? Of people who don't care about them.
Do you get depressed?
Of course I get depressed.
What do you think the ordinary human being can do about other people in the world?
I think... Everything that you illude yourself that you're gonna do for other people is turning out to be bullshit. And it's turning up to cause more damage. And I think the most difficult part will be to get yourself to behave different way. Because, for example, we sit in the table and we drink wine. And this wine made out of grapes. And those grapes were sprayed with chemicals. And those chemicals will cause the soil to be poor with nutrients. If we speak about all this and we drink wine, obviously we are not aligned with what we are saying. Serious thing you can do is change your behavior. And to realize that if you carry plastic in your hand, it's not going to vanish from the world. And if you are using paper, and if you are using water, and if you are using resources of earth, in an unconscious way, you shouldn't waste more resources and fly to poor countries in order to help, because it's not true, it's not serious, it's not aligned with anything. And sometimes I think the world is so messed up by now that if we will not make a radical change, and if we don't want to elude ourselves that some people are going to die, there is no easy way. And you have the people who don't care about anybody, they care about their corporation, and you get the people from the organization, the charity organization, who only care about people now, at this moment.
Well, thank you very much to David, a young Israeli activist, for allowing us to interview him there. And to Anthony Page, of course. Regular listeners might wonder where our sort of slightly cheesy little sounding jolly theme tune at the beginning and end of the show actually comes from. And Tony Gosling, our producer and contributor of features, is here to chat about it now. Hello.
Hi, John. The theme tune we use for our show here is actually borrowed from a BBC series called Shoestring, which is about a radio detective that was based here in Bristol. This series was made by the BBC in 1979, and they had a second series in 1980, two lots of 13 50-minute episodes. It was a crime drama, as I said, set here in Bristol. I mean, if you sit and watch the programme, you will recognise many of the places. Obviously, a lot of the city centre around St Nicholas's Market and all of the places like the Gorge and Suspension Bridge are in every episode. Eddie Shoestring is this detective who's played by Trevor Eve, and in the drama Shoestring used to work in computers, but he had such a hard time, he managed to get so stressed out that he had a mental breakdown and ended up living on a boat in the floating harbour here in Bristol. So then he got into being a bit of a private eye. He works in the series for a radio station called Radio West. Now, this is loosely modelled on, I think, on BBC Radio Bristol. And the interesting thing about it is that the station has got several presenters who are very dull and anodyne, and Eddie sort of is brought in to try and jazz up the station and make it a little bit more close to reality and a bit more exciting. He also, people may remember, drives a red Ford Cortina estate around all over the city. And in one of the episodes, Harry H. Corbett, who's famous for being in Steptoe and Son, plays a rather burly private security guard. So a lot of the actors from, you know, the 70s and 80s are included in the series.
Yeah.
But the question is, after 30 years, why have the BBC not released it on DVD? Especially as they would quite no doubt make quite a lot of money out of it. And I've had a little look into this. The answer is that because the series was set at a radio station, this Radio West, occasionally you've got in the background, you've got very, very faintly, you've got the pop songs of the time from, you know, around the late 70s and early 80s. Mm. And according to the BBC and Network DVD, who tried to release it, that they had all sorts of trouble actually clearing the rights for these songs. Anyway, it's a great tragedy because it's one of the best dramas ever filmed in Bristol, and it's strange that it's not been available for such a long time. I'm pleased to say that over the last month or so, it has become available through a website called www.tv-memories.com. That's tv-memories.com. They do quite a lot of old series which have disappeared, and another one which I've seen, which I got from them a few weeks ago, is the series of The Borgias, which is quite an amazing series, again from the late 70s, about the Pope and about the Borgia family in Italy. So if anyone wants to know how to get hold of it, there's the website. But these series come for the princely sum of £13 each, and there are two series of Shoestring and just the one series of The Borgias. And if you go onto the website and ask and send an email, you get a little note back saying send the money to Mark Small, P.O. Box 175, Shepley, Huddersfield, West Yorkshire, HD81DF. And that website, again, is tv-memories.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Tony. Samuel Taylor Coleridge lived near Bridgewater and Somerset near Nether Stowey, and David Parks reads one of his poems now. It's Kubla Khan, or A Vision in a Dream, a Fragment, a poem that famously he would have completed were it not for a friend interrupting him whilst he was in the middle of writing it. And then after he chatted to his friend and went back, couldn't remember what the rest of the poem was he was going to write. And here it is now.
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. And here, with forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover, a savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon, was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, with ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift intermittent births huge fragments vaulted like rebounding hail, or chaffy grain beneath the thresher's flail. And mid these dancing rocks, at once and ever, it flung up momentarily the sacred river, 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale, the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man, and sunk in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult, Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. A damsel with a dulcimer, in a vision I once saw, it was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song? To such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice. And all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware. His flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey dew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise.
That was Kubla Khan, written by Samuel Taylor Coleridge and read by David Parks. A lesson in ignoring the doorbell if it goes, if you're in the middle of a creative flow. This show is broadcast in Preston, and it is that I have in mind when I say this. Dialects reporter Anthea Page met some Spanish students from Madrid who are now living in Preston, and this is what they had to say about their adopted town.
So, what are you doing in Preston?
We are working there. We are working
there. How long have you been in Preston?
Well, a year and a half, more or less. Yeah, a year and a half. Yeah.
Do you like Preston?
Well, it's a nice place to stay. It's a little bit small for us. We are living in Madrid, so well, it's totally different. But there's plenty of young people, so well, we enjoy it. Abingham Park is really nice. We always go for running to Abingham Park, and we enjoy it. It is a pity that they are cutting the trees now, because they have a disease. But well, I think that it is important for nature, maybe.
Yeah, the Preston City Council should take attention to the park, because the park, they should care the park.
What's
The park was really, really nice. I don't know if they will plant again the trees or not. I don't know.
They were...
But they should.
Century trees, I think. So it is a pity to have lost them.
Yeah.
But well...
What did they do to the trees?
They have cut it.
Were they diseased?
Yeah. They have a disease, so... Yeah, but it is a pity because now, well, it's empty. They were really, really nice. But it is okay, well, I think it was necessary.
So what do you think about the weather in Preston?
Well, this weather, don't ask for about the weather. Spanish cannot say anything about the weather here. Well,
how do you cope with the weather?
Well, we have to do it. I mean, in the end, you get used to go out. Even if it is raining or not, you don't care about that, but it is not so comfortable as having sun, as in Spain. We were really happy today to have sun. So.
What, you find sun today?
Really, yeah, in this area, in
San Davis.
San Davis.
Lovely, lovely day.
Really? Lovely. Well, if you go out, you can see the stars, so there's no clouds.
Well, thank you very much to those Spanish students from Madrid, and that was their views of Preston.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now read by Malcolm Grieve, this is a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, entitled Prisoner and Acid.
Secrets and Lies, unearthed by David Southwell. It's the job of government spooks and spies to keep secrets, and to lie. They are paid to be masters of deception and disinformation. We all know this, but few question one of the implications of it. How can we ever trust anything they ever tell us? Intelligence agents specialise in gaining accurate information and planting misleading information. This means they know more secrets than anyone else and are better at keeping them hidden under a barrage of believable falsehoods. Their campaigns of disinformation can lead to such a widespread belief in misinformation that anyone who challenges the official version of events they have engineered appears crazy. How insane does it sound to suggest British spies helped terrorists murder their own citizens? Or that one of the most surreal TV shows ever seen was based on a real secret agent prison? Sometimes you can get away with revealing highly confidential information openly, as long as you don't tell people what you are showing them is classified. When it comes to revealing a secret to full public glare, no one comes close to George Markstein. Markstein had worked as a military correspondent during the start of the Cold War. Before moving into writing for television, he built up an incredible range of sources within the intelligence community. Through his contacts, he heard about the Mad Major, an ace British secret agent during the Second World War, who was too much of an asset to kill, but who had become too deranged to be allowed to go back to occupied France. The Mad Major was taken to an establishment known as the Cooler, a Scottish castle where he and other spies were to be held until the end of the war. Unfortunately, post-1945, some of them were then transferred to another facility for prolonged, secure retirement. While working with Patrick McGoohan on the TV show Danger Man, Markstein told the star about the retirement home for spies, and together they created the basis for the cult TV show The Prisoner, in which a British master spy resigns and is taken to the mysterious village, where he is held against his will. Later, Mark Stein revealed even more about the Mad Major in his best-selling novel, entitled The Cooler. Over the years, research has shown that the original cooler was at Inverlair Lodge in Invernessshire, an establishment heavily guarded by the Cameron Highlanders during the war. In the early 1980s, Mark Stein would take close associates to his London gun club, where a special firearm, a Walther PPK, was displayed. This gun had once belonged to the Mad Major himself. Even 60 years after the end of the war, the full history of the cooler and the Mad Major remain classified. Given that some of the files have been categorised maximum burial, meaning they remain classified for 100 years, the secrets of the real-life village look set to be kept for some time to come. For many, learning that the CIA undertook pioneering research into LSD and is responsible for its widespread use today is a revelation. If you are one of these people, the following sentences may be so shocking you'll need to sit down to listen to them. In the 1950s, as part of its MKUltra program researching mind control, the CIA began research to find new drugs to be used as truth serums. After experimenting with a range of pharmaceuticals, including marijuana, morphine, cocaine, and near-lethal doses of caffeine, they realised that LSD had the most potential as a chemical tool in espionage. Upon this discovery, agents began the process of testing LSD in the field. After giving up on surreptitiously dosing fellow agents and having their plans to serve LSD-laced punch at the CIA Christmas party spiked by their superiors, they turned their attention elsewhere. In 1953, Frank Olson, a civilian biological warfare expert, was given a glass of Cointreau spiked with a massive dose of LSD. 9 days later, he met an untimely death, falling from the upper story of a New York hotel. However, the testing on unsuspecting civilians continued apace. The CIA bought a property in San Francisco, 225 Chestnut Street, where they ran a brothel. Entitled Operation Midnight Climax, prostitutes were paid $100 a night to lure customers. The men would be plied with LSD-laced drinks, while CIA agents observed the effects of the drugs, and any bedroom action, from behind two-way mirrors. They also worked with doctors at the National Narcotics Hospital, where they gave unknowing black patients steadily increasing doses over a 75-day period. Plans were also drawn up to try and dose a whole platform of people on the New York subway. Agents even set Timothy Leary on the path to become a global advocate for the drug. The CIA appears to have stopped testing LSD in 1966, causing one of those involved, George Hunter White, a narcotics officer seconded to the project, to comment, "I was a minor missionary, but I toiled wholeheartedly because it was fun, fun, fun."
That was Prisoner and Acid, a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Well, Jeff Sparks, our reliable What's On man, is busy lurking around the MI6 building with a pair of binoculars and a dodgy-looking Macintosh in London this week, so we've got Johnny standing in for him, and he's going to give us a What's On guide.
Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday 28th of April, Sonic Boom 6 will be performing with support from Knockout and also On-Off Switch at The Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On Thursday 29th of April, John Cooper Clarke will be performing at Thunderbolt on Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Into Friday 30th of April, Pink Floyd Experience will be performing at The Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Steel Blue Rose. They are a contemporary country group who hail from America, and this is the track Better Late Than Never, and is from the self-titled debut album, which was released in 2007.
Life is short, it keeps getting shorter. No free time, cause life's getting harder. Deadlines, commitments, responsibilities, and in the end, there's no time for me. I got a dream rattling around my head, but when it's time for me, it's time for bed. I need to step back and set my priorities so I can make my dream a reality. I'm gonna reach for the stars, gonna do what it takes. Keep pushing forward if my back breaks. Holding on to a dream that'll last forever. I know it's late, but better late. Grown, they can fend for themselves. They don't need me to put food on the shelves. They can cook and clean before I get home. If they don't like it, they can live on their own. Gotta work all day, do the same old thing. But what I wanna do is go out and sing. I'll join a band and pay my dues. At this stage of my life, I've got nothing to lose. I'm gonna reach for the stars, gonna do what it takes. Keep pushing forward if my back breaks. Holding on to a dream that'll last forever. I know it's late, but better late than never. My friends found out, they said it's too late. I'm a working mom, I should accept my fate. But I got the strength and I got the desire. I gotta go out and set the world on fire. And the place is packed, they're here for me, that's a fact. Then the house lights fall as the guitar squeals. It's no longer a dream, baby, it's for real. I sang my songs and tried to leave the floor, but the crowd kept screaming, they wanted more. Everyone lined up for my CD, I could tell they were all so proud of me. I'm gonna reach for the stars, gonna do what it takes. Keep pushing forward if my back breaks. Holding on to a dream that'll last forever. I know it's late, but better late than never.
That was Steel Blue Rose with Better Late Than Never from the self-titled debut album. For more information, you can check out www.steelbluerose.com and also www.myspace.com/steelbluerose. On Saturday 1st of May, there is a DJ set from Groove Armada with support from Tom Maddicott and also Graham S. at Moles Club, which is at 14 George Street, Bath. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 1st of May, from The Jam, will be performing with support from Dave Sharp at The Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 and tickets are £18 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 2nd of May, All In One Helmet will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That's it all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much to Johnny Royden, our engineer there, doing the What's On Guide, standing in for Jeff. And if you like eclectic music, then check out the Sample Show, which is coming on later on today at 8 p.m. So come back and check out Johnny Royden's music show later on at 8 p.m. And if you're not particularly a fan of health and safety regulations, then I'm sure the Sonic Boom 6 will be a terrific act, because the last time I heard, they formed a human pyramid out of all the people watching them in the middle of the dance floor. And they do like to have a good bog roll fight as well. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect Radio is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on BCFM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk, and Dialect Radio is one word. You can find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, and you spell indie media with a Y, so it's I-N-D-Y media, indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Thank you very much to our studio guests David Phipps and Kerry McCarthy. Reports this week were Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, and the studio production this week was by Johnny Royden. The producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or you just want to come along and watch the show being recorded, please do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. So from all of the team here at Queen Square Studio in Bristol, thank you very much for your company, and until the same time next week, goodbye.